Stand by, and we're recording once again. And yes, we got a countdown. So sorry about the little bit of excitement there where our memory card got full of stuff. Now, do you remember where we were in that discussion?
Yes, I mentioned, of course, that I had written the proposal to obtain a reverse geometry mass spectrometer, the 35 projects. Uh-huh. And then upon return from Fred's lab, first the FTICR discussed the construction of the home build. But now coming back to the reverse geometry instrument, that grant was not awarded by the Netherlands Organization for Pure Research, I mean the Dutch National Science Foundation, because Professor Dijkstra, who was professor of analytical chemistry at the University of Utrecht, he managed to get a grant from his own university to buy such an instrument. Mm-hmm. And so the Netherlands Organization for Pure Research thought they will try to get the time for me to do measurements on that instrument when it was installed. But they managed not to get access to that instrument. So what then happened, of course, that I try to get collision activation experiments done with colleagues outside the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So with the University of Bonn, with Professor Bynum, with Professor Jennings, and so that induced also a lot of international cooperation in that way. Mm-hmm. And that was for me it was a negative result that I didn't get the instrument, but on the other hand there was a positive side on it, so that we could cooperate more with the colleagues outside the Netherlands. Yeah. Then in the end, I received then upon again submitting a proposal, I think it was in 1980, then I managed to get the money for a reverse geometry instrument at the end of 1980. And then the instrument was installed in 1982. And that was a Fiji Micromass ZAP 2HF mass spectrometer. Fiji Micromass ZAP 2HF mass spectrometer. Yeah. With, of course, a new data system. So everything included. So then we could do ourselves, the mass selected collision activation work. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I had been in 1980 at the University of Colorado in Boulder with Chuck DePue, mm-hmm. where I presented a summer course consisting of 10 research lectures there. Mm-hmm. So I was again back in the United States. But then, and another thing what I would like to mention is, when I received the grant to buy a reverse geometry mass spectrometer, then Professor Los, the director of the FOM Institute in Amsterdam, I had a very good relationship with the physicists there, he invited me to join their institute.
His name is Professor
Los. L-O-S.
Oh, okay.
L-O-S. Joop Los. Mm-hmm. He was the successor of Jaap Kistemaker.
Oh, okay.
And Jaap Kistemaker was the first director of the FOM Institute. Mm-hmm. AMOLF, you know, in the literature, mm-hmm. AMOLF, which stands for Atomic and Molecular Physics Institute. Yeah.
Okay.
But then I said to Joop, Los, that's very nice that you invite me, but I just got the grant to buy that reverse geometry mass spectrometer, which took me 8 years. And I cannot say, I cannot accept your invitation, because that is not fair to the Dutch National Organization for Pure Research, the chemistry division. Okay, but I've been for 12 years also consultant at the FOM Institute, so I had still the also the cooperation with the physicists there, so there was no problem. So that went on. So the research was done both with the homemade FTICR, mm-hmm. with the Virium MAT 711. Then the MS9 was replaced by the ZAP instrument. And also there we did experiment, for example, with negative ions. And we did an experiment where we had a singly charged ion, a negative ion, collided it, and made a doubly charged negative ion out of it. That was a very neat experiment, because you don't expect that.
No, I mean, how do you get the...
No, but I remember the discussions in the group, and being next to the instrument, and then, of course, the conclusion was, why not? It might have, might work.
Yeah.
And it worked. Yeah. It worked.
So somehow you managed to stuff another negative, like charge.
We could eject an electron from a negative ion to get to a doubly charged anion. Mm. And I thought that Helmut Schwarz was very well, very excited, and there were other people. We did many projects with that instrument. We continued cooperation with the outside world, so to speak, so with the colleagues in the world. I have had a lot of cooperation also with Helmut Schwarz. Mm-hmm. It is simply too much to mention all these projects. But then I wanted to like to have an additional thing on the ZAP instrument. I think there was a double collision cell which I wanted to have. Mm-hmm. Because you know that you can then, with a double collision cell, you can eject or deflect the ion beam, and so you get the neutrals, which then in the second cell can be ionized. Eh? Mm-hmm. That is to study neutral molecules mm-hmm. that came in. And I tried to get money for that, not from the research organization from the Netherlands, but from the organic chemistry lab, where I had a chair in organic mass spectrometry. Mm-hmm. And that gave some problems. And I think that I made so much... I told about so much about it that the SON organization, SON is for the chemistry division of the National Research Organization, mm-hmm. So typical for chemistry. So they invited me then to talk about a possible transition from the University of Amsterdam to the University of Utrecht. Mm. And I had serious discussions with that. The dean at that time, I didn't inform him, because as long the discussions were going on, that was not good to do, you understand that.
Yeah.
But then we got a new dean, Jacob Molijn, a young man from chemical engineering in our faculty of chemistry.
M-O-U-L-I-G-N.
Okay. You know, the itch. Jacob Molijn. And he found out that I had discussions with the people in Utrecht, together with the chemistry division of the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, but we don't let you go. And then I said, Jacob, you can say that, but if the financial situation is not changing, then I will go. Mm-hmm. He looked in the details about the financial... how the financial things were distributed over the chairs in organic chemistry. I had a very good relationship with the organic chemist, of course.
Yeah.
But then it turned out that it was not an equal partition of the money.
Mm-hmm.
That was my complaint also about it. And then Jacob went to the board of trustees, and he managed to say to arrange a research institute for me. He said, we don't let you go. We offer you a research institute of mass spectrometry. And we will rectify the financial situation. So you will get an operating grant of 150,000 guilders per year. You will get two permanent staff members. Of course, I work all the time on myself with the group. And you will get also some additional technical people. So that was a very good offer. And I had, of course, to balance that with the opportunity to go to Utrecht.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, first of course, that was approved by the Faculty of Chemistry. They had a voting about it, and they were unanimously in favor to keep me at the University of Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked at the transition to Utrecht with all the difficulties also.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to stay at the University of Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And that made it also possible, in addition to the founding of the Institute of Mass Spectrometry, but also to get now money to upgrade the ZAP to HF with a quadrupole attached to it. Yeah?
Yes.
And then detection system. So that gave us the opportunity again to do new experiments, of course. Yeah, I think the ZAP, well, first of field ionization kinetics, we did that with a much higher resolution than on the Virion MAT 711. Mm-hmm. But also, we could use the instrument what also Professor John Bynum described in his papers, because he was heavily also connected with VG Micromass to develop the ZAP. We could do experiments like a complete laboratory on its own. For example, I would like to mention one experiment, which is perhaps nice to hear. You made a methoxy anion in the ion source from methanol.
Okay.
You did a mass selection so that you had pure methoxy anion.
Okay.
Then you did a collision to convert it into a methoxy cation by stripping off two electrons.
Okay.
Then they passed the electric sector, which was then used as a means to purify the beam, of course. Mm-hmm. Realized there was an enormous reduction in signal, I think a factor of 10 to the 5th. Then that methoxy cation was decelerated to, let's say, more or less thermal energies. Mm-hmm. And then ion molecule reactions were performed in the quadrupole. And we did it with several reagent molecules. Mm-hmm. And then we analyzed the products of these ion molecule reactions. And we compared that behavior of the methoxycation with that from its isomer. And that is protonated methanol. So that is CH2OH plus. Now, we found that the methoxy cation reacted like a radical acceptor, an electron acceptor, so electron transfer, whereas the protonated methanol acted as a proton donor, which is a completely different chemical behavior. So that was something like, you use the mass spectrometer as a complete laboratory on its own. Synthesize, purify, do a reaction, identify the products, etc. Yeah?
Yeah.
So then we are in 1988, that we became the research institute, the Institute of Mass Spectrometry. And before the MAP was upgraded, I think that was 89 or something like that. But then, meanwhile, of course, also the Virion MAT 711 instrument became very old. And that induced me now to fight for a four-sector instrument. Because the four-sector instrument gave, of course, opportunities that you had a high mass, a front-end mass resolution, so that you could have a very purified beam and then do collisional activation, etc. in the second double focusing section. But this was not for research. I mean, the ZAP was most of the time used for research.
Okay.
Yeah, I can say it was always a mixture between analysis for the organic chemist and inorganic chemist, yeah. But the ZAP was really used more and more for research. And the Virion MAT 711 had to be replaced. And so I put it forward to get a new instrument to also to do advanced analysis for the organic and inorganic chemist. Mm-hmm. By the way, Jacob Molijn said to me, you have the operating grant of 150,000 per year, every year, and we let the organic and inorganic chemist pay for the analysis you are doing. And Mike, that gave a little bit problems in the sense that the colleagues didn't like that idea. We didn't overcharge, of course. That was not the case. But I thought, this is reasonable. If I found a doctor for a prescription, then I get a bill home to pay. So why not for the analysis? Mm-hmm. Later on it was normal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I managed then to get the four-sector GEO machine with all kinds of ionization methods on it. So electroionization, chemical ionization, field absorption, mm-hmm. electrospray, not MALDI. Of course, the activation unit for making the emitters. I must say, the GEO machine, that was a JMS SX-102A, I think. It is a marvelous instrument, designed like the MAT, mm-hmm. for analytical, very stable. If you a nominal mass calibration, that held for more than a year. Mm. And actually, you didn't have to recalibrate, but then sometimes you did recalibrate. Yeah. For high resolution, that's another story. But I had the same results I heard from Shell in Amsterdam, the north of Amsterdam, the Royal Dutch Shell Research Institute there. That is the Royal Dutch Shell Lab. Mm-hmm. They had the same experience. Mm-hmm. And that had a resolving power of 50,000 in the first section and about 80,000 in the last section, as far as I remember correctly. So that was a really good instrument. Then, meanwhile, also, in 86, we acquired a Fourier transform ion cyclone resonance instrument from the Bruker Company. The so-called CMS 47, 4.7 Tesla. Mm-hmm. So, in addition to the homemade FT-ICR, we had then a commercial FT-ICR. So you could also then make ions outside the cell, because the drift cell, the FT-ICR homemade had only a cell, and then you introduce your compounds by leak valves into the cell itself, and did there the ionization and reactions. But with the Bruker instrument, you could externally make the ions and then guide them into the cell and do there the reaction. Mm-hmm. And you had pulsed valve addition of gas to accelerate the ions and then do collision activation, something like that. We developed a sustained off-resonance excitation, which was also developed here at Purdue University, I think. But that instrument was used purely for research,
Okay.
And what can I say more about it? You can imagine that having the interest in high front-end resolution, so that you can select a mass with a particular elemental composition under high resolution, and then do a collision experiment and get the fragments and then analyze them by high resolution again. Mm-hmm. So that resembles, of course, a four-sector double focusing instrument. Yeah. So we did that experiment. We did that by selecting the ions, applying so-called ejection pulses very carefully. So you had first, you ejected a broad range of ions, but avoided to eject the ions of interest.
Yeah.
And then with fine-tuning, long duration pulses, you could get that high resolution to select, for example, if you had a mixture of diisopropyl sulfide and an alkane, you could select, you could isolate ions with, let's say, from sulfur-containing ions and then isobaric ions containing only hydrogen, carbon hydrogen, and then do the collision activation experiments. We had a front-end resolution of, in the beginning, of around, as far as I remember, 20,000. Mm-hmm. And then after the collision, 400,000, which is normal for FT-ICR. Mm-hmm. And Alan Marshall did this with his Swift methods. Hey? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we did it by simply using well-defined pulses. And you know, get high resolution takes time.
Oh, yeah.
That is, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that instrument gave us also the opportunity to do all kind of ion molecule reactions again. And one of them was, for example, to make noble gas dimers. Radical cations of noble gases. For example, xenon double plus, xenon 2 radical cation or argon. And you could then replace one of the noble gas atoms in that dimer by a neutral organic molecule, or by two neutral organic molecules. So, for example, we made the dimer radical cation of water.
Okay.
The dimer radical cation of methyl chloride. Yeah. And well, that was work, for example, on the two center three electron bond systems.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is of chemical interest. I mean, during my study, I heard Professor De Boer talking about it. Eh? So many years before I did these experiments. The thing is, if you have a radical cation of a sulfide, and you take a neutral sulfide, then you have an electrostatic interaction, because you have a positively charged species with a neutral species. But then you have then three electrons, which you have to accommodate in orbitals. Now, you need then two molecular orbitals. And one of them is lower in energy, and the other one is higher in energy. But if you have two electrons in the lower level and one in the upper level, then you get bonding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So these are stable species.
Mm-hmm.
But we found out also, if you take a sulfide with a longer alkyl chain, for example propyl or butyl, then the difference in energy between the lower MO and the higher MO decreased. So that meant also that the bond became weaker.
Hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I must say that before we did that with the Bruker instrument, we had done experiments on the homemade, because Helmut Schwarz approached us, could we show the existence of radical cation dimers in that was done with Asmus. We showed the two center three electron bonds also in cooperation with Helmut.
Mm-hmm.
So that was nice. What did we also do in cooperation with Helmut was, you had a dystonic ion. A dystonic ion means that you have a charge and a radical which are separated on the different elements. And you can compare that with the normal isomers. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
So I remember if you take an methyl chloride, or you take its dystonic ion, that is a CH2 radical ClH+,
okay,
you could distinguish these ions by ion molecule reactions with NO. Okay. With the normal ion, you had a charge transfer, and with the dystonic ion, you had a proton transfer. So these kind of things. Hey? So we played real pure organic chemistry in the gas phase. And so there are many more examples which I described in the mass spectrometry review article.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is what the instrumentation concerns during my career. Hey?
Mm.
So we had different sector machines, and we had at least two ICR machines. The CMS-47 instrument has been upgraded at the end of my career. Not to a 7 Tesla, but let's say with better software.
Mm-hmm.
But we did run also, because I leave now a little bit about the chemistry we did. Mm-hmm. We can always see what we have to mention more. But you know that we did also many analyses for not only our own laboratory, but also for the faculty, also outside the faculty, for colleagues in the Netherlands who didn't have the equipment. But we also did run samples for David Reinhout. I would like to mention him, Professor David Reinhout, from the University of Twente.
How do you spell that one?
Reinhout, I will spell. That is R-E-I-N-H-O-U-D-T. Reinhout.
Okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
He was a professor of organic chemistry there. And was working in the field of supramolecular chemistry.
Okay.
And so we did round samples for David, and but David also did see that MALDI was a method we didn't have.
Yeah.
And that could be very beneficial for analysis of his compounds.
Mm-hmm.
But I had asked the Netherlands Organization for Research, the chemistry division, to have a so-called new cell for the Bruker instrument, the Infinity cell.
Mm-hmm.
That had a better performance. You can make a lot of things yourself, but that... So David found me and he said, what do you think about it? I said, David, I thought about it, but I cannot... ask for money for that instrument, mm-hmm. because if you ask too many, too much, different things, then it will fail in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said, okay, what I will do, I will apply for that instrument, try to get money also from the University of Twente, and if that is successful, then I will put the instrument in your institute.
Twente is...
They call it in the Netherlands University UT, University of Twente.
And Twente
is T-W-E-N-T-E. T-W-E-N-T-E.
So, okay, just UT.
Yeah, UT.
Okay.
So he managed that, and with the permission of the Board of Trustees of the University of Twente, that instrument was indeed installed in our institute. And it was a perceptive MALDI-TOF instrument, a Voyager.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, the perceptive biosystems, and then a Voyager MALDI-TOF. Yeah?
Okay, perceptive biosystems.
Yeah.
MALDI-TOF.
So we use that simply for his work.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not only for his work, but I mean... His work was done on that, yeah, when he needed analysis. It was
sure.
Very nice.
That's a good arrangement.
Yeah, it's a good arrangement. And an exceptional arrangement because the Board of Trustees of the University of Twente allowed it to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Then, about the FTICR machine, I have to come back for that from Bruker. And because I was presenting a lecture in Uppsala in 1988, I was invited by Bo Sundquist to give a lecture on FTICR. And then in the audience, there was somebody who said after the lecture, "It was very nice, I'm your host tomorrow. And you will be, I knew that I would go to Stockholm." And he said, "I am your host, and you will present a lecture now tomorrow for physicists only." And he said, "It was a very nice lecture, but you have to leave out the chemistry." And that was in Professor Ingmar Bergström. And he was the director of the Manne Siegbahn Institute.
Okay, I'm going to get some more names here. Ingmar.
Ingmar Bergström. Ingmar. I-N-G. M-A-R,
okay.
And then Bergström is B-E-R-G, S-T-R, an O with an umlaut,
okay.
M, Bergström. He knew Jaap Kistenmaker very good, very well, because he was a little bit younger, but a few years, but not more.
Okay.
And so he picked me up at Stockholm station, and then we went to the Mannerheim Institute. Well, you know, Mannerheim is a very well-known name
in physics. Excuse me, I need a spelling for that institute.
Mannerheim, hey? M-A-N-N-E.
Okay.
And then Siegbahn, S-I-E, J-G, yeah?
Okay.
Siegbahn, B-A-H-N.
Oh.
Siegbahn.
Okay.
Yeah, I was a Nobel Prize winner, I think, in the beginning of the last century.
Okay.
For X-ray, I think, also. But okay. And then he explained the reason why I was there. He showed me the setup, and they would like to make a storage ring there with 50 meters diameter, and then with penning traps and FTICR traps in the ring to do mass measure experiments on highly charged isotopes.
Mm-hmm.
Noble gas species or something like that. I don't know all the details because they had a cooperation also with the CERN in Geneva. And Ingmar and also Jürgen Kluge from the University of Mainz in Germany, but also working at GSI, the Gesellschaft für Schwere Ionen, and doing experiments in Geneva on short-lived isotopes.
Mm-hmm.
They had found out that I did FTICR, and they wanted to do experiments in storage rings with these traps.
Mm-hmm.
That was the reason. Jürgen Kluge, I can spell also his name.
Yeah.
J, U with an umlaut.
Okay.
R, G, E, N. This is his forename. And then Kluge, K, L, U, G, E.
Okay.
I have also written that down in the mass spectrometry review paper.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So you can always find it there, Mike.
Okay.
So Ingmar was showing me then the lab, and he showed how they made argon 18 plus.
18?
Yeah, argon, and remove all the electrons.
Oh.
Yeah? You know, the higher charge, the more energy it requires.
Oh, yeah.
They liquefy themselves, the helium there. And, Ingmar was talking to me like, I said, Ingmar, I'm a simple physical organic chemist. I'm not a physicist. Of course, having that good relationship and being consultant at the FOM Institute in Amsterdam,
mm-hmm.
of course, I learned how physicists were thinking. I mean, you always end up in a potential energy diagram.
Yeah.
But then he said to me, what do you think about highly charged ions? I said, well, if you have an argon 18 plus and you bring it in the neighborhood of an organic molecule, it might explode. Yeah. He said, okay. So we will apply, we will submit a project. And then he will be the principal investigator because he was retired. And the chance to get funding, hey, because that will be a proposal submitted to the European project, hey, which you have to submit to Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did my part, and Ingmar made a nice proposal out of it. And he warned already, he said it might be, the funding is less than 15%, whether it will be successful.
Yeah.
But we were successful. So we got the money, and then we had group meetings either in Stockholm or in Mainz or in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And I had then the project for highly charged ions making in an FTICR. I managed to get a physicist in my group from the Karl Marx University in Leipzig.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is, the PhD student was Holger von Keuding, H-O-L-G-E-R,
mm-hmm.
then space, and then von,
mm-hmm.
V-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
space Holger von Keuding, hey, so that means K, O with an umlaut, D, I, N, G. So Holger had to become acquainted to our idea of working as chemists.
He's a physicist.
And we could, in principle, make a xenon 10 plus with the Bruker instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But to make these highly charged ions, we needed, of course, high energy electrons. So first we tried, that was Franz Pinks, of course, was also involved, the lab technician, to fire electrons from outside into the cell.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't work because the magnetic field, they destroyed, the problem.
Oh, yeah.
So Ingmar, when he heard it, he said, yeah, you have to put an accelerator in the corridor and then fire the ions, But I said, but Ingmar, how expensive is that? Yeah, that was 200,000 guilders or something like that. I said, yeah, that is impossible for in chemistry. We had 150,000 operating budgets. And don't ask a chemist for this instrumentation at the chemistry division of the... You can imagine that. They will say it's physics.
Yeah.
But then Holger, he tried to make these high-energy electrons in the cell. Well, the electronics then was blown up, but that was repaired. No, it was no problem. But in the end, he was able to make xenon 5 plus.
Okay.
But the abundance was too low to do experiment with it. But what he found with the xenon 4 plus was that if that reacted with neutral xenon, then you did see not only one electron transfer, because you isolate a certain isotope.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look at the reaction products.
Yeah.
And from that you could derive there was a single electron transfer, but also a double electron transfer. And the double electron transfer, I found it very interesting because, if it, a chemist always thinks, in that case, is that a stepwise reaction or a simultaneous, in one-step reaction. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
But I reasoned with Holger, And stepwise cannot be, because as soon as you make a singly charged xenon with a xenon 3 plus, it will repel.
Yeah.
So the cross-section to have again an electron transfer will be very low, isn't it? So it must be a single transfer of two electrons.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was, Mike, that if you go from xenon 4 plus to xenon 3 plus, then you have only a single electron transfer.
Hmm.
But if you go to xenon 2 plus, then you see, again, a single electron transfer and a double electron transfer. And Holger measured the rate coefficients for these reactions, and the double electron transfer is more efficient than the single electron transfer.
That's weird.
That is, yeah. We did it also with krypton.
Okay.
And with argon. But the lower the mass, the more difficulty, because then it is not more anymore in the mass range of the FTICR instrument.
Sure. So
because the cyclotron frequency,
you get smaller and smaller masses.
Yeah, exactly, yes. So, I would have loved it to continue these kind of experiments to really highly charged ions,
mm-hmm.
because I thought it is an even odd.
Yeah? That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, and then having these experiments, and Holger was very careful. I mean, he remeasured many times so that we were sure what he was observing is, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I said to Holger, we should have calculations on that. Hey? So I approached Evert Jan Barends from the Vrije Universiteit.
Mm-hmm.
I can spell his name, but also again you will find the reference there. Evert is E-V-E-R-T,
mm-hmm.
Barends, B-A-E-R-E-N-D-S.
Okay.
And I had even also in cooperation with Evert Jan Barends, because one of my PhD students, Matthias Bickelhaupt, did his master degree study with him. And so I phoned Evert-Jan Barends about, is there a theory who could then explain why the double electron transfer would be more efficient than the single electron transfer. And then he said, yeah, that is nice what you do, but you are working at thermal energies. And there is no theory, not in the Netherlands. So then Jürgen Kluge, because, you know, Jürgen Kluge and Ingmar Bergström were, of course, informed about this work because of the cooperation. So Jürgen Kluge mentioned a colleague in Berlin and one in Kassel. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly the names anymore. But they got in touch with me. Mm-hmm. One of them, he listened and he said, nice, you are working in the wrong energy range. 500 electron volt is the minimum energy. Then we can do it. Mm-hmm. The other one would like to come over to Amsterdam, but he said also, you are in a very low energy regime. Cannot be done. Mm-hmm. So that contact was lost because that, yeah. And later on, I met a professor of theoretical chemistry who had retired, and that was Laurens Jansen from the University of Amsterdam, but he worked in Switzerland. And there was a reception, and so I talked with Laurens Jansen. Mm-hmm. If you would like to have spelled his name, yeah. I can do. Laurens is Laurens. Mm-hmm. And then Jansen is Jansen. I think it was with one S. I have to be careful. Okay. I have to be careful because you have them also with two S's. And so I talked with Laurens because I served for the. He was dean of the Faculty of Chemistry, and I was a member of the the board of at that time. Mm-hmm. That was in the, I mean, at the end of the 70s, so I knew him very well. And I said, Laurens, we have these observations, and we do like to have theoretical calculations. He said, Professor Sederbaum from Heidelberg. Hmm. So I got in touch with Sederbaum in Heidelberg and explained by telephone what we observed. He said, don't worry, your observations are good. Mm-hmm. Because that was my concern. He said, no, it's okay. He said, but we cannot do quantitative calculations. That's out of the question, only qualitative. Mm-hmm. But then, in some way, we had, I said to Holger, trying to get in touch with his students there, but in some way that contact was also lost. Mm. Now, yeah, okay.
So the fellowman, the gentleman in Heidelberg, his name was?
Sederbaum. Sederbaum. But then, of course, and that is the reason why I'm mentioning Holger von Keuding as a physicist, we had also a laser group in the Faculty of Chemistry, the physical chemists, and I was interested to play with lasers also, with ion beams. Mm-hmm. And that could be done on the ZAP instrument. Mm-hmm. Then Holger was, of course, the right person to work on that. Because with the ZAP instrument, you could decelerate the ions to the ion before the ion quadrupole, mm-hmm. and then fire a laser to the beam, and then look at the fragments by using the quadrupole. That was the idea. Mm-hmm. And so Holger started to work on that, and I must say that very helpful was also Piet Kistemaker, mm-hmm. P-I-E-T, and then Kistemaker, yeah, it's the same name as the Jaap Kistemaker, mm-hmm. Kistemaker. He was appointed when the Institute of Mass Spectrometry was started to work. I said to Jacob Molijn, who I mentioned before, we should have a cooperation with the FOM Institute, and therefore Piet Kistemaker was appointed as a part-time professor in physical mass spectrometry. Yeah, mm-hmm. My chair was, by the way, changed from organic mass spectrometry in chemical mass spectrometry. Mm-hmm. But Piet was, of course, also the right colleague to work on that laser experiment, to change the instrument for laser interactions with selected ion beams. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing was, of course, to decelerate the ions more properly than for the quadrupole. So a new lens system was made. Because, you know, if you decelerate ions, they start to...
Yeah, they're going to sit there idly being nice.
Yeah, so the it should still be a well-defined ion beam, and they managed to do that. And therefore, we have done experiments, cross-beam, laser, ion beam, and then collect the or look at the fragments in the through the quadrupole. That was the construction of that instrument. Measurements were done by Ilse Aben.
I-L-S-E-A-B-E-N.
She was a postdoc in my group, coming from the Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam,
okay,
and had studied physics there. So that was very helpful, of course.
So how, I mean, is the interaction between the laser beam and your ions, is that's not going to be very productive?
No, exactly. No. Because one of the problems we found out was you had also spontaneous metastable ion decompositions.
No. Mm-hmm.
That in addition to the laser-induced dissociations. So, Mike, what is it? We make always the following comparison. You would like to know the weight of a captain of a ship. You weigh the ship plus captain, and then you weigh the ship itself, and from the difference you find the weight of the captain. So this was the case with these kind of experiments.
The hard way.
The hard way. And so therefore, these experiments were done by Ilse Aben, yeah? And therefore, Holger was asked to make an orthogonal time of flight coupled to the ZAP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So you do the laser experiment and then deflect the ions in the orthogonal time of flight to get rid of the metastable ion contribution.
Yes.
Yeah? So Ilse had done it with the quadrupole, and Holger changed the quadrupole in an orthogonal time of flight. And we have done experiments with that instrument, and they were successful. At least they proved that it worked, and then I had the end of my career.
So you actually took the existing force or instrument with the quadrupole on the end and replaced it with time of flight.
Orthogonal time of flight.
A sector instrument front end. With
their orthogonal.
Yeah.
And the timing, of course, you know, to put the laser on the select ion beam and then deflect the ion, the fragment ions into the time of flight,
yeah.
That was, of course, yeah, you can only do that by a computer, of course,
yeah.
The timing of it. But that was, again, you can always look back in the mass spectrometry review article, that it is described in a brief way. But it worked. But yeah, then I had the end of my career.
I still wanted to talk about this laser interaction thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you had to pick a frequency that was going to be effective. I mean...
This was an ultraviolet laser.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was... you made that selection based on the idea that you knew that this would give you the... would be interacting with the molecules or the... ions in a way that would cause a decomposition.
Yeah, sure. Ultraviolet laser. Yes.
Yeah,
there was money for the to buy these lasers.
Mm-hmm.
Because a colleague in physical chemistry, he managed to get money to work with lasers in the faculty, so several colleagues could make use of it, among others, myself. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he's very powerful. I mean, it'd be reasonably powerful, I guess.
Yeah.
The lasers they were.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, that's...
I think I have now described more or less all the instrumentation,
right.
The changes we've made,
right.
The aim of the... Yeah?
I think so, yes. So, are there any other items that you want to discuss in that outside of the instrumentation part of your... You've talked a lot about interactions with different people,
yeah,
and the importance of meeting different people and going to travel and working in different laboratories.
Yeah,
I noticed that you had done some work with pyrolysis.
Yes.
What was that all about?
That I can immediately explain it to you. Pyrolysis mass spectrometry had been developed at Curie Point Pyrolysis at the VOM Institute in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
By Meuselaar en Jaap Kistemaker.
Uh-huh.
And how did I get in touch with that? Josef Huber, whom I mentioned in purchasing the Varian Mod 711 instrument, mm-hmm. the analytical chemist. Mm-hmm. He had a student and he would like to make use of the pyrolysis mass spectrometry, mm-hmm. which they made at the FOM Institute. Mm-hmm. And so Josef said, look at it and yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course I thought, yeah, later on, because Josef didn't continue that cooperation or contact, so he transferred it to me. Mm. Then I was talking with Henk Meuselaar, who moved to the United States, to Utah, Salt Lake City. But he was a medical person, hey, right. Henk Meuselaar. Yeah. And so I had Henk Meuselaar at home, and then we were discussing it, and I said to Henk, what I would like to do in pyrolysis is take a look at the molecule of methionine. Why the interest in pyrolysis? Because in the electroionization work worldwide, there were people saying, that mass spectrometry resembles like pyrolysis. Mm-hmm. But I never accepted that idea, because in electroionization you make ions. And their reactions are driven by radical charge. Mm-hmm. And in neutral molecules, there is no charge. Mm-hmm. So is it the same as electroionization, pyrolysis? And that was a good opportunity, of course.
Oh, yeah.
So I said methionine. Why? Because methionine was studied by us by high-resolution mass spectrometry on the Varian Mod 711 instrument. Mm-hmm. And we had measured manually under high resolution conditions the elemental composition of the ions from the molecular ion down to the mass 40 range.
Okay.
The reason was that Bob Johnstone in England from Manchester, he had written a paper on methionine, and it was very critical and skeptical with respect to a paper published by Sweck and Jung, I think. Sweck, Harry Sweck from Ames, Iowa.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I didn't mention him during the trip that I made through the United States, because I visited Thomas Kinsel. That was my host. Mm-hmm. But I had met Harry Sweck. Mm-hmm. Nice thing, Mike. He was working on an instrument where you made positive ions there and negative ions there. Yeah, in opposite directions. Uh-huh. But later on, I did see that paper, and they used the concept of charge localization to account for the fragmentation of molecular radical cations. Yeah, also Bynum and Williams, they have published a paper on that, that the radical plays an essential role. And we use that concept for interpretation of mass spectra. You know very well, it is a concept, is it a theory? Yeah, it's a concept, mm-hmm. It works, is it then true? I mean, if you work talk with theoretical chemists, they will say the charge is not localized, it is distributed, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was a workable concept. And so Johnstone had measured this mass spectrum with an AIMS-9 instrument coupled to a data system. Mm-hmm. But if you put the threshold too high, then you will miss small peaks. And therefore, he found sometimes ions with only one elemental composition, whereas we, by manual peak matching, found four compositions.
Oh boy.
For some of the peaks, eh? Mm-hmm. We said, the charge radical localization, it works. Mm-hmm. This, because he was skeptical and said it, no, but it. We said that Harry Sweck, his paper was very explicable by using the concept of charge localization. But now the mass spectrum of a pyrolysis of methionine resembles very much on an electroionization spectrum. So that gives you an idea. Ah, pyrolysis still resembles then EI. Mm-hmm. But it is a completely different behavior, because there we did the elemental composition, of course, by labeling, mm-hmm. of the product ions. And for example, if you look at the ion, molecular ion of methionine, it will show a peak at mass 116 by loss of H2NOH. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So let me see, that is correct. It is 17 and 16 is COH. Yeah, I have to look it up. But the other, in the pyrolysis, you find an ion then by expulsion of a nitrogen-containing fragment. In the electroionization spectrum, it is the loss of a methyl and a carbon monoxide.
Mm.
So quite different.
Yeah.
Then I have to look it up exactly. And so there were more peaks, eh? I remember 101 and 104. So seemingly they were the same masses, but the elemental composition was different. So we simply could say, no, it is different.
Hmm. And so this occurred in the pyrolysis?
Yeah, Curie point pyrolysis, I have it here. Yeah, hydroxylamine. That is the 1-2 elimination. Hydroxylamine is NH2OH. That was upon pyrolysis, and upon EI it was a methyl radical and a molecule of water.
Hmm.
A molecule of water and a methyl radical. Sorry, not CO, but a molecule of water and a methyl radical. And so there were other, 101, for example. That was here the elimination upon pyrolysis that was due to the loss of a molecule of water, carbon monoxide, and molecular hydrogen, whereas methane thiol was eliminated from the molecular ion of methionine.
Mm-hmm.
So completely different. So that was a very nice experiment. Yeah?
Yeah.
And then Jan Ballinga, this work was done with Maarten Postumus. He was a PhD student of Huber. But I got the supervisor of Maarten Postumus. Maarten Postumus, the name is M-A-A-R-T-E-N. And then Posthumus. You can almost know what it is. Post. P-O-S-T. H-U-M-U-S.
M-U-S, okay. Very good.
And you know, so we continue that Curie point pyrolysis at the former institute with Jan Dallinga, a PhD student from my group. So we looked at carboxylic acids and aromatic compounds and found also differences between electroionization and pyrolysis.
Mm, okay.
Yeah? But then we stopped. I mean, you had to, to put in proposals for the science research organization in the Netherlands.
Mm.
And this was a cooperation, really, to do that with the physical chemist, with the physicist. But you know, the world of physics and chemistry is different, and it holds also for these organizations.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I can imagine. Particularly when it comes to grant applications.
Exactly, exactly. So that was one, and that was okay. And it gave me enough confidence to say pyrolysis is different from electroionization.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think your initial reaction is that it should be.
Yeah.
There may be one or two things that are going to be common.
Yeah.
Commonly produced, but
yeah,
they're probably produced in completely different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ways.
Yeah.
They are.
Yes. 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 Yes.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about earlier that I didn't get a chance, and that is if you're doing these organometallic compounds,
a lot
of the time they kind of tend to gum up your ion source because the metal, once you make the ion, then you can start plating out metal on your insulators, and you start to get, is this a problem that
No, I must say that we cleaned very, very frequently the ion sources. We had simply a scheme, mm-hmm. and also we always looked at backgrounds, but metals, we did some organometallic ions also in the FTICR, but that is less critical.
Yeah.
It is for the sector instruments where you have these high potentials.
Yeah.
And that the insulators fail to work as they should be. Now, Mike, the Franz Pinkse, the lab technician, he was very careful all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So better to spend time on cleaning the iron sources than to always in a hurry to do measurements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was standard, of course, also on Friday afternoon, the machines were set on baking.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only organometallic were they, but also
sure.
sometimes you had molecules, hey, then you looked at the background on Monday morning, it was a clean instrument.
Uh-huh.
Heating, uh-huh. heating, of course, heating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
tape it, also with the ICR, tape it and heat.
Uh-huh.
Get rid of all the, hey, because that is what physicists don't like if they talk with organic chemists.
Yeah.
That was also what Ingmar Bergström was saying, oh, that stuff, oh, dirty, dirty. No, but...
So you had a very specific lab regimen that you followed to keep the instruments...
Yeah, yeah, Franz Pinkse and I were on the same line. Let's say it should be clean.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires time. But then you lose less time than when you don't do it, because then you end up in a mess.
Yeah. And the data that you can't trust the effort, the data you get.
No, exactly. Yeah, but also... for example, Andries Bruins, one of my PhD students, he worked on the so-called benzyl oxy butane species. Eh? That is, you have a benzyl oxy at one side, benzyl oxy at the other side, separated by a chain of four methylene groups.
Mm-hmm.
And we did study that for basic reasons, eh? Basic iron chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
What we always did, I like that, have symmetrical molecules, because this was a symmetrical molecule,
yeah.
but then put O18 at one side and O16 on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Put ethereum on one side and hydrogen atom there, and then see the interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very nice, okay, because then that gives an eye-opener
mm-hmm.
how complicated the chemistry then is.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You can imagine, yeah? And there are many examples from my group where we did that, yeah? But the compounds of Andries, they were not volatile. So you can imagine we did these experiments in the AEI machine. And that was not like we take the molecular iron. No, you did a number of experiments, which was time consuming, of course.
Yeah.
Looking at Mater's tables. Now, you could do a collisional activation reaction. You looked at it. then... baking, because we knew that these compounds were not very volatile and polluting the source. So measurements were done on Friday for these molecules. Monday, then we assumed it was by heating the whole weekend it had gone. And you looked and there was no background anymore except of water or something like that, you know. And then 3 weeks later, somebody came in with an analysis, an organic chemist, and Meneer Roselaar, I mentioned him yesterday,
mm-hmm.
who was running the analytical work for the lab at that time. And suddenly, the compound of Andries appeared in the spectrum.
Hmm.
So we said, what is going on? But then we had a compound which... simply removed it from the surface because it was better bonded to the surface, and then pushed it, surface exchange. So, because the binding of the other molecule was better than from Andries, so if you would know everything, you could use that for making clean surfaces.
Oh, yeah. Crazy,
yeah. Yeah.
Those are the interesting things. What's this with, I got a three-electron bond, I have a little note here about a paper that they're working with, three-electron bond.
Yeah, Sam de Visser did that.
Mm-hmm.
That was on sulfur-containing ions.
Okay, the sulfur work.
Sulfur work.
Mm-hmm.
And the chloride was interesting, because the methyl... Yeah, you know, we had interaction with Helmut Schwarz about the 273 electron bond. Eh? That was an experiment done before Sam de Visser did the disulfides.
Okay.
But as I said before, from Professor de Boer already in the past, far past, I learned that the three electron bond is two center three electron bond was very interesting because they had these so-called colloquia. Mm-hmm. So where students had to scan the literature and give a presentation. Mm-hmm. And from that I remember that, that was interesting. But methyl chloride was an interesting one because we found two species. Well, the methyl chloride, the dimer, was made, as I said, taking a noble gas dimer, replace then the noble gas atoms in that dimer by methyl chloride. Mm-hmm. So you get the radical cation dimer of methyl chloride. Mm-hmm. And then we looked at its properties, looked at its bond dissociation energies, and we found there are two species. That is, a dimethyl chloride where the chlorine atoms are bonded to each other in a two-center three electron bond. Mm-hmm. So there's a symmetrical structure. Mm-hmm. And the other one was a dystonic ion, that means a CH2Cl proton bonded to a normal methyl chloride. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, CH2Cl, H, Cl, Ca3. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And so we studied by ion molecule reactions the behavior of these ions. We determined, of course, the strength of the bond of the three electron two-center bond. And we found that two-center three-electron bond species, so the symmetrical one, was responsible for electron transfer. If you take a methyl chloride with a neutral methyl chloride, you can have an electron exchange. Mm. That species was important for the electron exchange. Whereas the other one, the CH2ClHClCa3, that was responsible for proton transfer. Yeah?
Okay.
And there were also calculations done at the, not ab initio, these were the programs, Gaussian, mm-hmm. number, yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. And that fitted well with our experiments. So we could say the bond dissociation energy for the symmetrical structure is higher than for the proton bond structure. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing is that how is the two-center three electron bond species, how is that transformed into CH2? Radical Cl H Cl Ca3. Mm-hmm. That is a neutral methyl chloride is dragging a hydrogen atom from the carbon atom to the chlorine without changing their atoms. It's really helping to get the hydrogen atom moving from carbon to chlorine. And the same was shown in the dystonic ion, because this is a dystonic ion you are making, from methanol. You know, methanol has, dystonic ion is CH2 radical, O, let me see, H2 plus. Whereas methanol is normally CH3OH. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And in that case, that was proven by the group of Henri Audier, who I know very well, in Palaiseau, near Paris, the École Polytechnique, where a water molecule, if you do it in a chemical ionization source, a water molecule, if that sees an ionized methanol species, then the water molecule says, okay, I pick the hydrogen atom from the carbon atom and move it to the oxygen without exchanging its hydrogen atoms with that hydrogen atom which is moving from carbon to oxygen. Hmm. So it is a catalyst.
Yeah.
Yeah?
That's pretty strange.
It is strange, but theoretical chemistry helps
to
understand, because there's been
They've done calculations.
Okay. Or nowadays, you see, if you do this kind of work without doing calculations, it's impossible. No. Always calculations. And they are very accurate, up to 2 kilojoules per mole. Mm. So both, let's say, You always know, would like to know in a bimolecular ion molecule reaction, what is the energy of the starting material, so the ion plus the neutral. Mm-hmm. Then you would like to know the transition state. And they would like, of course, to know the energy of the products. Mm-hmm. And from that you can learn that sometimes the activation energies, as we call it, or to pass the transition state is too high. So you have to go to other transition states. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that is very helpful. But also for unimolecular reactions. Yeah, unimolecular decompositions, if you excite an ion, then to know the activation energy is the threshold where you have to pass the transition stage to come to the products, then you can exclude many reaction pathways because they are energetically unfavorable of not possible. So that part is has been developed over all the years. If I look back since my master degree study, well, I wanted to have to do these reactions that I mentioned in the beginning. Mm-hmm. That has been fulfilled, not by me, but by the developments also in theoretical chemistry. It's very helpful. There is a symbiosis between these two fields. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And they can also calculate larger systems.
Mm. Yeah.
Although, if you would like to have precise calculations for large systems, it becomes difficult. It is still difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, there's a limit, and there's more power coming with computers and software, but still.
But you have, for example, the density functional theory is heavily applied. You have Ab initio, mm-hmm. Popel and his group. Yeah, mm-hmm. At Pittsburgh, I think, yes. Mm-hmm. But the density functional theory that helps to reduce the computer amount of calculations. They are more simplified, but there is... Matthias Bickelhout, who received his PhD with me, he did his master degree in theoretical chemistry with Professor Evert-Jan Barends, whom I mentioned. Mm-hmm. So Matthias... has a lot of experience with DFT theory, but also with Ab initio. And so when he joined my group, he did experiments with the homemade FTICR, and then did also calculations, of course. And that helped, that induced also Sam de Visser to do calculations for the two-center 3-electron bonds of metal chloride and the sulfur compounds. That was then also possible, yeah? Mm-hmm. And since then, that was done in my group. So you see, it is you. Well, let me say the following about a career. If you are appointed as a professor of, let's say, organic chemistry or mass spectrometry, then you are damned because you have to work as long as you are on the chair on mass spectrometry. Mm-hmm. You cannot say suddenly I will do something else. Mm-hmm. So my method was every 5 years you try to get something new in the group without throwing away the good shoes you had. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And in that way it was built up. Mm-hmm. So I'm still excited about electron ionization. It is a method which is still used in GCMS, mm-hmm. but I think the chemistry... when you apply electron ionization, the chemistry is very transparent. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah, I guess electron ionization will be with us for...
Yeah!
Forever, huh?
Yeah.
Well, it's a good method for... Does it work for what it's good for, and that's important.
Yeah.
Well, we've covered a lot of material here. I was curious, so we didn't say much about your patent... experience, if any. Have you had any patents or bothered with patents or is patenting items?
We have thought about making patents when we built the FTICR tricks there, but you know, a university is not suited to handle that mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. So no.
Okay.
Okay. So we were very open. I mean, let's say the emission control unit.
Yeah.
We thought that was an interesting thing, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
So we showed the Fiji Micromass people, because we bought the Fiji Micromass machine, mm-hmm. and we wanted to have field absorption on it.
Yeah, right.
But they were not so good in field absorption as MAT. Mm-hmm. So we showed them. We showed also MAT. No problem, because also be aware that if we needed the source filing for the software, we could get it.
Yeah.
So that's also, yeah? We didn't misuse that.
Right.
Trust. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think I used the word trust. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then they said, yeah, it's very nice, of course, but it's too expensive to commercialize that. Mm. That is where I didn't have to bother about, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, they had to think in those terms. Give and sell it and make money.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the other problem is if it worked and made the ionization method more useful, maybe they could have made money on it.
Yeah. 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 No, yeah. With respect to field absorption, you know, Bernard Linden from Bremen, he got his PhD with Beckeye, and he has developed LIFD, liquid injection field absorption ionization.
Yeah.
Well, he has presented that in the last year all time also in the ASMS. Mm-hmm. And that has become a very user-friendly method to operate field absorption. Also for, let's say, air-sensitive compounds or very labile organometallics. Here's examples where other methods fail, but that works. And I know that Bernard also sells these devices to industries. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
That is an issue in the ionization area, is that sometimes you want a very soft ionization technique.
Yeah.
And that's not, they're not always available for it to be as soft as you would like.
Yeah, well, I would say the softest ionization method that I have found from experience is field absorption.
Okay.
That's really soft, hey? Mm-hmm. But yeah, we know the challenges, hey? That I think it has been made user-friendly, but then, of course, the masses which you can do with it compared to electrospray and MALDI, yeah, the masses are lower in the end. Mm-hmm. But, you know, analytical chemistry, there is not any instrument which can do everything. There is not any method which can do everything.
Yeah.
Forget it.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What I'm impressed by is by the work of, I've been this week, of course, at the Purdue University. Mm-hmm. And DAISY, hey, what Graham Cooks and his group has developed. Or DART, developed by Chip Cody. Mm-hmm. You know that well, hey? Direct analysis in real time, I think, is the term for DART. Hey? Mm-hmm. And then DAISY by Graham. But now, paper spray, the paper spray method, where they analyze these molecules by dipping it on a paper and mm-hmm. put a potential and then get the ions into the mass spectrometer. Mm-hmm. It is very impressive. Mm-hmm. And I must say that I was glad that I was, after so many years, again in the lab of Graham, and I said to him, I see the time coming that you will have this kind of very simple, these are not, they are still mass spectrometer, but it's so miniaturized, mm-hmm. That will be a standard thing to have in organic chemistry labs, in clinical labs, in medical centers or in hospitals. It will take, of course, an additional years to commercialize it in a way that you have an instrument like a black box, which everyone can use. Mm. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I think that time is coming. Wow. And I must also say, they use a lot of chemistry to, let's say, get good results out of it. I mean, again, if you do chemical ionization, you can do it with CH5+, but you can do it also with C4H9+, and so you can do it with other reagents. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was a pleasure to see that they simply use organic chemistry to get very good results via use of these ionization methods. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Chemical approach. Mm. Combined with instrumentation. Hey? Simple instrument. Nou ja, simple. I mean, in depth, of course, you have to take care of many things, but no, it is very elegant, I think.
Yeah, well, Graham believes they have a mass spectrometer in every garage or
kitchen
or something.
No, but really, it is impressive, yeah.
Yeah, well, he's an impressive fellow, isn't
he?
No doubt about that.
Yeah.
Let's see, so we're talking pretty much about most of these experimental areas. What do you have any publications you consider to be your most important?
Yeah, I have thought about it, of course, when I did see that question.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, that is of course a personal thing, of course. Eh?
Yeah.
I have listed a number of them.
Okay. Can I have the list?
Yeah, it is. But it is in Dutch, hey? No, but I can. I simply can give you mention the list.
I've got your bibliography here.
Yeah.
So I can tick them off of here.
Yeah.
From there.
Yeah, but it is in Dutch. But I can read it to you.
But you've got the dates and whatnot. I can just pick them off out of this group here.
Yeah, okay. Now, I think that the first publication on 1-nitropropane, eh?
Okay.
The master degree study.
So that was one of the earliest
this.
Okay.
Mike? Because we simply did give a scheme based on the deuterium labeling that the McLaughlin rearrangement was occurring in a stepwise fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Okay.
Then I think also the phenyl ethyl ether and phenoxy ethyl chloride stuff. But that has a lot of publications.
Okay.
It started with Carla Thijsling.
Okay.
Carla Thijsling.
In 19, got a year that is?
74, I think, right. 74, like that.
Okay.
And that was also work, who was involved? So Carla Thijsling is a PhD student.
Okay.
Michael Gross and Dave Russell.
Okay, Gross and Russell. I'll just make a note here, Gross and Russell.
Jan van der Greef.
Jan, that's the same time period, 74?
Yeah, something like that, yes.
Okay.
The key word is phenoxyethyl chloride.
Okay. Phenoxyethyl. Unfortunately, this is the slowest dub computer. Because I can, if it would work. Let me take a minute here and see if I can go to the Dropbox and go to this resource here. And
yeah, I mentioned already a few of them, so I can.
So we're going to look for phenoxy?
Yeah, phenoxyethyl chloride. Okay. Or phenoxyethyl halides.
Phenoxy search first for any field.
Yeah, because you can select them from the list then, eh?
Yeah. So, let's blow this up. And we've got, I've got 74.
Yeah.
This, there's the collisional activation study of C6860 ions generated from molecular ion. That was at 77, Borchers.
Yeah, that was a cooperation with Bonn. Now you see the effect that I didn't get the instrument and that I decided to do cooperation outside the Netherlands, and Carla Thijsling was involved in that.
Okay, so that's one of those.
One of those.
Phenoxy
yes.
Paper.
Yes.
Okay.
And and Wim van der Hart in the end, and Michael Gross with Dave Russell. It was a difficult problem. You know, Mike, let me simply say the reason why we did study that compound. When I started to work with the Drifzel ICR, I did the experiments myself, because there was no group at that moment. So, and then I decided to study phenyl ethyl ether.
Okay.
And phenyl ethyl ether has two possibilities. That is that there is a hydrogen atom transfer from the methyl group to the aromatic ring, and then elimination of ethylene.
Okay.
That is the McLaughlin arrangement. Giving you the enol form, the keto form of phenol, keto form, or it is transferred to the oxygen atom and then it produces phenol.
Okay.
And that turned out by our molecule reaction that only phenol was formed.
I see.
No cyclohexadienone. And then we said, okay, let us now put in an halogen atom, one of the hydrogen, the methyl group replaced by an halogen. Because then you have a negatively an atom with a lot of electrons around it that doesn't like the oxygen atom. So we force now the system to get the hydrogen atom transferred to the ring and not to oxygen. And that had have taken many years. I think the publication was in 82 with Wim van der Hart in the end, that we could show, if you from that publication you can find all the preceding publications. Then we could say definitely that there is phenol formation, but there is also cyclohexadienone.
Okay.
And the phenol formation is via an intramolecular catalysis. Well, that is,
Okay.
And I think why I'm excited about it, regard this as an highlight, that is because in, I think that was, Pierre Longuevial from France. He had at the end of the 70s, around 1980, he had firm evidence for the occurrence of iron molecule complexes during the unimolecular dissociation of ions. So, you know, you have a transition from unimolecular to bimolecular. So, if you talk about an unimolecular dissociation, then in the end it is ion molecule chemistry which is going on. So, the barrier between unimolecular and bimolecular chemistry, we call that is very thin ice. Now, that phenoxyethyl chloride, people, we had also an idea about an iron radical complex when that work by Carla was done, Carla Thijsling, but we excluded that because it didn't fit with substituent effects which we applied. But if you look at the work of Longuevial and also Tom Morton around the same time here in the United States, then they would say phenoxyethyl chloride, that is an that reacts via an ion molecule complex when you do the intermolecular dissociation. But the fact that we find still the formation of cyclohexadienone, so the keto form of phenol, says it is not only ion molecule chemistry. On the contrary, in that case we have covalently bonded structures. So that means, and I like that, you have to be careful, very careful, in the interpretation.
Oh, yeah.
What is really going on.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, definitely. There's no question about that.
So that was a highlight. Now, yeah, then, of course, the Drifzel ICR, I think that was a highlight, that we modified the Drifzel FT-ICR machine, but that has to do with the highlight in my career, that is the trip through the United States in 69. Yeah, that's a highlight. And of course also the highlight is the few months that I was a visiting scientist in Fred McLafferty's lab in 74. Yeah, the fact that I had then the opportunity to go to the ASMS in Philadelphia, and the fact that we met Michael. Mm-hmm. That seems as simple as that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the highlight is the construction of the homemade instrument within 1 year and a day. You can imagine that.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Then, of course, also, if I go to chemistry, you know, the protonated methanol in reacting with neutral methanol. That I can explain to you, because Hines from St. Louis, Monsanto, he had studied the reaction of methanol and protonated methanol, and he proposed a reaction which we thought is for organic chemists not so attractive. We had more the idea that it would go through an SN2 reaction. That's in organic chemistry well known. Whereas that possibility was not taken into account by Hines. I don't know whether he is still alive. But now we did the following experiment to show that it was due to an SN2 reaction. That was Jan Kleingeld. So if you look under the name Kleingeld, Kleingeld, you find a number of papers of him. But that was one of the first experiments we did with the homemade FTACR. If you take normal methanol, then you know you have a 0.2% O18 labeled molecules, natural occurring O18, and 99.8 O16. And there is some O17, but it is 0.04.
Yeah.
Now, if you now make ions from methanol with electroionization, and you have a relatively long pulse of electrons making the ions, then you fill the trap with a lot of ions, too much, it is overloaded. But then you start to eject all the ions from the cell, except the protonated methanol O18.
Okay.
And then it is in a bath gas of Ca3O16H for 99.8%. Is it it?
Okay.
Yeah? So now you can see what the reaction of protonated methanol O18 is doing with neutral methanol. And if there is an SN2 reaction, then the neutral methanol will attack the methyl group of the protonated methanol and will substitute the water molecule. So the water molecule is getting off, and so you get unlabeled protonated dimethyl ether. Yeah? And that was the experiment saying. So that was nice. So we had an evidence for that.
Yeah.
Of course, in the complex, because nature has to be cooperative with you, there was a little bit exchange, but not so that it destroyed the ID. And then that triggered, again, publications from American groups, because some of them said, no, it is not an SN2 reaction. That is too high energy, because substitution reaction, you have to change the hybridization among the carbon atoms, so that is a high activation energy, the energy stays too high. But in the end, the theoretical chemist said, you are right. It is an SN2 reaction.
Good.
Also, interesting was, I think, a highlight, the formation of an hydride sulfated water molecule, H3O-.
Hydride...
H3O-.
Oh, yes, okay.
Because, you know, Mike, many things are found by accident. Well, perhaps not the right word, but you understand what I mean.
Serendipity,
yes. We were interested to do an so-called Meerwijn Meerwijn Verlaay reduction. Again, you can look in the paper. But it is that if you take a methoxy anion and you react it with methanol, CH2O, and you label one of the systems, either the ion or the neutral, and then look whether you have a hydride transfer, H- transfer, from the ion to the neutral. There's a Meerwijn Pondor-Verlei reduction known in organic chemistry. So we use also organic chemistry as a guide to look in reaction in the gas like they have solvents, yeah? And but to make the methoxy anions, you needed water. So you start in with making OH minus, yeah? And Jan Kleingel did the experiment and suddenly found that there was a peak at mass 19.
19.
Negative ion. And but we knew that the frequency of the FTICR machine could interfere with the frequency of the radio station in Scheveningen. Yeah. So, because you could pick up signals, of course, from outside. And that was real, hey, the radio Scheveningen, that is near Den Haag. So immediately we said, is it really an ion or is it perhaps a picked up signal? Let us label with deuterium, O18. Yeah? And then we found the following. If you, yeah, let me take a look at the reaction that is easier for me because then I can use the words. Yeah, it is almost there. Yeah, here. So, what is the reaction? The OH minus, and then we reacted it with formaldehyde.
Okay.
Because, you know, we work with methoxy anions and then with formaldehyde, so we replace now the methoxy by OH minus. And then we found, again, the formation of H3O minus. And if you label with deuterium an unlabeled formaldehyde, then you will find that the reaction product does contain the deuterium atom. And if you put a label in O18 in the formaldehyde, then you will find, let me see, it is a proton abstraction of the methanol that gives you H2O plus HCO minus. Yeah, HCO minus is actually carbon monoxide carrying anhydride. Then it sees the water molecule and says, because that complex cannot separate because of the energy, yeah, that is endothermic. But then HCO minus sees that neutral water molecule which is formed in the first step and says, ah, take over the hydride. The water likes the hydride. So that means that if you put in a label in the formaldehyde with O18, the O18 will not be seen because you see the oxygen atom of OH minus in the product. Or if you take O18 OH minus, water, yeah, then it will end up in the product. So we could see that. And that was an exciting reaction, of course, because I like these simple ions. And then we presented that in FIMIRO, we had submitted it to the International Journal of Mass Spectrometry and Ion Physics. It is in the publication list. And John Paulson from, what is that, Air Force Base lab?
In Wright Patterson?
Let me see, because Paulson and Henschman. Yeah.
There's a
the lab that is an Air Force base, yeah. A henchman was from the Brandeis University.
Okay.
Paulson and Henschman. And they have seen it in a completely other way. Completely different experiment. So, but they had published that in an, I have given it here in the reference list. It was an abstract for a meeting.
Okay.
We didn't know that, of course. At that time, certainly not, hey?
Yeah.
And then later on, we extended that reaction by making NH4 minus. Because if you take ammonia, you can make NH2- in the negative ion mode. And if you react that with formaldehyde, then it makes in an exothermic reaction in that way HCO-, mm-hmm. which is the NH2+- abstracts a proton from the methanol, and then you get HCO-. So that reaction is exothermic, mm-hmm. contrary to the water reaction. And then that HCO- meets another ammonia molecule and transfers then its hydride to ammonia. Mm-hmm. So you get an hydrated ammonium molecule. And that has been studied also by spectroscopy later on. Yeah? So I like this simple chemistry. Eh? And another thing about it, you know, in chemical ionization, you could use H3O+ and NH4+. Mm-hmm. So you could start your lecture and say, oh, we'll now talk about ion molecule reactions of H3O- and NH4-. So people thought, huh, what's going on? Positive ions, isn't it? You know, negative ions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use H3O+, NH4+. No, but you had H3O- and NH4- species. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And we made even the radical anion of water. Mm-hmm. That was work done by Leo de Koning as a PhD study. Yeah? Mm-hmm. I must say, if you look up in the literature about H2O- radical, the radical anion of water, if you read it very carefully, we did, of course, performed deuterium labeling, mm-hmm. of course. We did elemental composition measurement, to be sure. It was a reaction with methylamine, ethylamine. It ends up then in a radical anion of water, but is not a water molecule in that structure. We think it is an OH- with an hydrogen atom. And where is the hydrogen atom? I personally think that it is at one of the hydrogen atoms of OH-. I have asked Matthias Bickelhaupt some time ago, but I don't know whether he has time for it, to do the calculations. Mm-hmm. But we wrote, I've always made doubts, and you know, if you do science, you don't want to make mistakes, eh? Mm-hmm. But then I have written together with Leo, taking all the observations from the experiments together, we are forced to assume that H2O- radical anion can exist as a stable species in the gas phase. Yeah?
Okay.
Well, my personal idea about it is, if you have a hydrogen atom in the neighborhood of a hydrogen atom of the OH-, O is attracting electrons. Mm-hmm. And we know well, from my study at the University of Amsterdam, the radical, protonated hydrogen is a stable species. And also the radical cation of hydrogen. Hey? I mean, you can bind hydrogen with one electron. Mm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So you know, so if you attract the electrons to the oxygen, you get something like an H+. And then there is a hydrogen atom in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So you can make H2 radical cation, more or less. Huh?
Mm-hmm. Crazy.
I had correspondence also with groups in the United States about it, and they accepted apparently that explanation, but I was very, very careful. Dipole stabilized carbanion ions I've written from dimethylformamide. You know the molecule of dimethylformamide?
I'm not very familiar with it personally, but...
it is HCO-N2 methyl groups.
Okay.
It's a very well-known solvent molecule.
Okay.
If you abstract a proton, when you make negative ions, then you could abstract the proton from the formyl position, but that is a minor reaction.
Uh-huh.
You can also abstract a proton from one of the methyl groups. Yeah?
Okay.
Because you make then a CH2, a carbanion, conjugated to a carbonyl group. So you can delocalize the negative charge, eh?
Okay.
Because you get CH2 minus and double bond O. And so you can delocalize the negative charge over the amide group, eh, the oxygen. But the funny thing is, these methyl groups are not equivalent in dimethylformamide.
They're not?
No, because one of the methyl group is more or less syn to the carbonyl group.
Okay.
And the other one is in the antiposition. Yeah? And it turns out that the acidity of the anti is higher, is easier to abstract a proton from the anti-methyl group than from the syn-methyl group.
Okay.
It's also known from theory.
Hmm.
And so the different behavior of the two methyl groups, you see that perfectly from the terium labeling.
Okay.
And I think that is a highlight also, but it confirms that the rotation of the around the N nitrogen carbon bond is not easy, because otherwise you could simply convert syn and anti by rotation. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that means that the N-C bond has a double bond character. And Mike, that has also been shown by gas phase NMR experiments. And the rotation is as high as far as I remember, around 90 kcal per mole. So that is 3.5 electron volt.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very difficult to rotate. And therefore we can see that the anti-methyl is from very different from the syn-methyl.
Mm.
One exchanges hydrogen atoms, the other one doesn't exchange hydrogen atoms. Yeah?
Crazy.
No, but chemically is a very attractive thing. I mentioned already, I see here emission control, in FAK. I mentioned already field absorption, negative ions. I mentioned also the problems with the streetcar in Amsterdam. I think that was also a highlight. I mean, to come up with a solution.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I mentioned here also the formation of doubly charged ions from a singly charged negative ion by collision. Mm-hmm. Strip of an electron from a negative ion. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
In general, I would say the bimolecular chemistry we did in FTICR. It was a real success.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? What I also would like to mention is skeletal rearrangements in ions. I like to solve puzzles, where you have to think hard, eh? And let me not to meant to go too much in detail, but simply show what we did, and the reason we did has to do with phenoxyethyl chloride. If you make the C6A5O CH2 ion, that is a phenyl O double bond CH2 plus ion, that behaved according to the metastable compositions very complicated. There was a narrow metastable ion and a broad metastable ion peak, so there were more channels.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the end we decided to make anisole, that is a phenyl with a methoxy group.
Mm-hmm.
And if you label that with carbon 13 in the methyl group, then what you will see, if you generate the M-H plus ion, so you get an hydrogen atom from the radical cap ion, you remove that. That ion loses carbon monoxide, but it doesn't contain the carbon atom of the methyl group. It contains a carbon atom from the ring.
Hmm.
So I would like to mention at this point the lab technician Tineke Molenaar Langeveld.
You want to spell that one?
It is T-I-N-E-K-E, that's your forename. Then Molenaar, M-O-L-E-N-A-A-R. Mm-hmm. Then not a hyphen, but a horizontal piece, yeah.
Okay.
And then Langeveld, L-A-N-G-E-V-E-L-D. She was the lab technician when I started to become in charge of mass spectrometry during my PhD, as I has explained. Then Professor De Boer said to me, Tineke Molenaar, she was a lab technician from him. He said, she can work with you, I don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has worked all the time during my career to make labeled compounds. She was very good in that, mm-hmm. in minimum quantities. And she learned, of course, a lot about mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
So you will see she is co-author on many papers.
Good.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So she did she made that synthesis of the carbon 30 labeled phenyl methyl ether. And Steen Ingeman, who was a permanent staff member also in my group, like Leo de Koning, he asked me also to help with the interpretation because it was so complex.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it was successful, I must say. But I think it is a highlight of what labeling can tell you.
Mm.
Yeah?
Sure.
Now, then I mentioned the orthogonal time of light and laser on the ZAP. I think that was, in the end, a successful project. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The highly charged noble gas ions, you know, single electron transfer, double electron transfer. I think chemically this was also very interesting. I have another one. Benzonitrile, you know, a phenyl CN molecule.
Okay.
Benzyl cyanide. Benzonitrile, yeah, benzonitrile,
mm-hmm.
phenyl CN. Tineke also labeled it with carbon 13. And now you look at the major stable ions. It loses HCN, hydrogen cyanide.
Okay.
And it contains only 7%, when you look at the carbon content, only 7% contain carbon 13.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we put a label in the cyano group. So 93% is coming from the ring.
Hmm.
Well, you have to read the paper. How we do that? You have a complex skeletal rearrangement, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah? But what is the interesting thing? The benzonitrile was a compound which was used to test our RKM calculations.
Hmm.
There they said the HCN loss was an 1-2 elimination from the aromatic ring,
mm-hmm.
making benzyne. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But now you see it is complicated.
Yeah.
There is a skeletal rearrangement going on.
Yeah. I'm not sure how that happens. pretty impressive.
It's pretty impressive, yeah. That I think the phenolium ion formation in Fred McLafferty's lab, you know, the Brown-Weinstein problem, yeah?
Okay.
That the phenolium ion, but later on we made also its negative analogon. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So, as easy you can delocalize the charge over the ring in a phenolium ion, so you can do with a negative charge. So we made the negative analogon. Yeah?
Okay.
Then field ionization kinetics, I think what was a very nice observation is the following, and it was done on the ZAP instrument, and it was always a wish of me. We had studied pentenols, unsaturated pentenols, also in cooperation with Alex Harrison from Toronto, one of my students, Jan Zwinselman. He moved also to the lab in the end as postdoc, to postdoc with Alex Harrison. But if you look at the phenomenological rate constant, then we found in the phenomenological rate constant two maxima, one at around 10 to the minus 11 seconds decomposition, and one around 10 to the minus 10. And that was due to the high resolution of the electric sector of the ZAP, that we could separate the maxima, which we could not do with the Varian MAT machine.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can do now, you can select a maximum. So you, that is to say, you select the ions with a lifetime of 10 to the minus 11 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And you do collision activation on these ions to get the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And now you shift to the one at 10 to the minus 10, doing collision activation, there is another structure. And we know the chemistry. So we could prove the structures by time-resolved MSMS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And I think it is the a unique example in the mass spectrometry literature. I wish that we had more of these examples.
Yeah, but, oh, they're pretty interesting.
Yeah, but it works only, Mike, if the ion at 10 to the minus 11 seconds is not rearranging anymore during its flight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And the same holds, of course, at 10 to the minus 10. So there are conditions which have to be fulfilled, yeah? But I think it was a nice experiment.
Yeah.
Time-resolved MSMS, yeah?
Yeah?
Then I mentioned already the use of the ZAP instrument as a laboratory on its own, the methoxyanion making, and then the methoxycation, and selected it, purify it, and then do reactions, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
What I also like to mention is infrared-assisted field ionization kinetics.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, field ionization kinetics, you can only see a primary fragmentation of a molecular ion. It is field ionization in a soft ionization method.
Right.
And so sometimes you simply don't see a fragmentation. And so you cannot study time-resolved a reaction. Now, then you could say, is that important? Well, yeah, that is the game that we would like to see this reaction. That is the science, yeah?
Yeah.
And Ilse Aben, whom I mentioned before, she had studied physics at the Vrije Universiteit and was used to lasers. So I said, Ilse, let us look at the use of infrared laser to warm up, vibrationally excite the molecules before they are field ionized, and then look whether we can fragmentation, and that worked well. That worked.
Good.
It's nice. I'm almost at the end. What I think is acidities of radicals. If you take methane, it's not acidic,
Right.
If you take a methyl radical, well, at least methane, you have to do a lot to get a proton out of it. If you take a methyl radical, that's possible. A methyl radical is more acidic than methane. If you take methyl chloride, you can abstract a proton from it, so it is acidic. But if you take the CH2Cl ion, the radical, radical, that's more acidic than the chloromethane. So we have found by, you have to play with thermochemical cycles, of course, to do it. But we found in general that radicals from these kind of compounds are more acidic than their parent compounds. Yeah?
Okay.
And if you look in atmospheric chemistry, there certainly will be, there will be radicals.
Yeah.
And if you incorporate these kind of things in schemes, reaction schemes, then I think it is a nice observation, and that we have established that they are more acidic, that to take into account. Yeah? Most of the time you think radicals are very reactive, but not in the way that they can act as acids. Yeah? I mentioned already the distinction between dystonic ions and normal ions.
Right.
Let me see. And I would also like to mention one method in the drift slice. Yeah, but okay. With regard to iron molecule chemistry, and that has been a recent paper together with Veronica Bierbaum.
Okay, Veronica.
Veronica, yeah, well, I'll call her always Ronnie, a nickname. But, and I know her since I was in 1980, of course, in Boulder, Colorado with Chuck DePew. She asked me, I think the year before, she was guest editor for the an issue of the International Journal of Mass Spectrometry for to celebrate the 65th birthday of Peter Armentrout.
Okay.
And so Ronnie asked me, can I contribute a paper? And I would like to contribute a paper, of course, to Peter Armentrout, but I wrote to Ronnie, yeah, Ronnie, I have no instrumentation anymore, and I have no group anymore, but most important, I have no instrumentation.
Yeah.
And then she said, well, if you propose a project, we can do the measurements. And then I thought about the following. We always did negative ion molecule reactions and using frequently the radical anion of oxygen, making from N2O. If you fire low energy electrons on N2O, you make O radical anion of oxygen by elimination of N2. And then you can do all kinds of reactions with organic molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And having been in Boulder and knowing that they are doing atmospheric chemistry, I thought, well, let us look at the radical cation of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And let it react with simple compounds like methyl chloride, methyl fluoride, tetrafluoromethane, methyl bromide, methyl iodide, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did the experiment with the flowing afterglow, with the help of students, of course. And in the end, that was a nice thing, because the radical cation of the oxygen atom is in its ground state a quartet.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the atomic orbitals of oxygen, if you look at that, and it is logical that it is a quartet, because the Hund rule says you have three electrons in p orbitals. Hund rule says you should have them in different orbitals. Now, the px, pi, and pz. And they are parallel.
Mm-hmm.
That's the lowest energy. So therefore, a quartet. But then, if you react this ion with the methyl halides, then if the oxygen atom would stay in the quartet state, it is impossible, because the reaction will be endothermic. They cannot occur.
Mm-hmm.
So during the formation of the ion molecule complex, at some stage of the reaction, there is a spin flop. That means the spin is inversed.
Mm-hmm.
So you go over from a quartet to a doublet.
Mm-hmm.
And that has not been considered so much in the ion molecule chemistry field.
Okay.
Ronnie would say it is not unknown, but it has not been considered in our field of ion molecule chemistry. So I was very happy with that. It is in the list of publications at the end of what I sent you.
Okay.
And that was a successful, I think a highlight.
Well, those are the ones that we want to get, and we get a chance to, make sure that we get them right.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Then I would like to, about FTICR, the homemade FTICR,
mm-hmm.
I would like to mention the notch ejection technique. Can I use the bathroom for a moment?
Oh, yeah, sure.
For two.
Yeah.
Because, you have, sometimes you have to get rid of some water in.
Okay.
Ejection technique.
Okay, let me make sure that we're still. Yeah, okay.
The notch ejection technique,
okay.
On the homemade FTICR. Because that is the thing where you scan to eject ions from the cell. You scan the frequency, and suddenly the ions you would like to keep in the cell, then you shift the phase of the pulse 180 degrees and then continue. And then at the point where you change the phase 180 degrees, these ions will stay in the cell.
Okay.
And that was developed by André Nuust and Jim Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
And we used that over all the years in the homemade FTICR. Mm-hmm. I think a colleague sometimes said you should have done more work on it. Of course, later on Swift, what was developed by Alan Marshall, that worked all very well. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. But I think it is a nice method to isolate ions in a relatively simple way in the cell.
Yeah.
It was not high resolution selection, eh? Mm. But it worked for our ion molecule chemistry perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah. So let's see, I don't know what we're doing here. Actually, a good question at this point. We're kind of getting towards the end of the major topics here, but what do you think is the impact of your research on the field of mass spectrometry over your career?
It's a difficult question.
Ah, well, I said you've had research, you've conducted research in so many different areas, and in the theoretical fundamentals of thermodynamics and ion molecule reactions, but then there's been a lot of instrumental
development. I think, Mike, that other people would say that fundamental gas phase ion chemistry, both unimolecularly and bimolecularly, but especially mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because, you know, why do I have such a problem with such a question? We were always interested to look how it exactly happened, driven by curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But many other people have worked in that field. So what is my contribution, and not only me, but from my group and the co-workers, etc.? Yeah. I notice that many people appreciated what we have done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was in West Lafayette this week in Purdue, then the people said that, with essential contributions, and that is a pleasure to hear,
mm-hmm.
and they were honest, I think. Did I do the work that people could use it or found it interesting? Yeah, that's difficult to predict.
Yeah.
Hey. Eh?
Okay, but I mean the fundamental studies I think are important.
Yeah, they are important.
Because they do.
That is something that I will be on that line. So if people will say, what is the use of fundamental research? Then I'm very Fundamental research is essential to get to innovations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But most of the time, the work what you do, you cannot predict whether it will be useful or, many years later.
Okay.
I mean, if I come back again to the Purdue University, they use chemistry there.
Yes.
To get the best results from the, for example, the paper spray
mm-hmm.
work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so then I say, I see then the usefulness of it. Mm. Okay, could I have predicted that? No. Now that's also, I'm a member of the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences, so we have many times these discussions, because you know, it has to be relevant for the society and innovative, etc. But there are older colleagues in the academy who says you never can predict whether it will be useful or not.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the driving force.
Mm-hmm.
If you could predict it, then you don't have to do the experiments anymore.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's as simple as that.
Yeah?
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've covered pretty much your career and the things that I wanted to talk about. I don't know if you have any other comments to make at this time, and if not, we can take a break and think about the individual in the group. So.
I think we have covered more or less the explore reasons and background for interest in. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think you yes. Now, the discussion on the on the field of mass spectrometry, I would like, of course, to mention that you have a list of names with research colleagues. Stijn Ingeman, he was a permanent staff member in my group in the end. Leo de Koning, they both got their PhD with me. Mm-hmm. Jan van der Greve, Tineke Molenaar, Jan Zwinselman, Tim de Boer. Susumu Tajima. Yeah, he was a visiting scientist in 1977. Mm. And I still very good contact with Susumu. He became professor of physical chemistry. Jan Kleingeld, I've mentioned. Matthias Bickelhout, Helmut Schwarz. Monique Born was a lady who did the acidities of radicals and heats of formation of carbenes. In heats of formation of carbenes. Albert Heck, he did also very basic research in my group, but then after having postdoc in the United States, he came back and became professor of biological mass spectrometry at the University of Utrecht. And he is at present the director of the Netherlands Center for Proteomics. Satoshi Nakajima, that was a co-worker of Susumu Tajima, mm-hmm. because we worked at the end of my career, when I was a guest after my early retirement at the Vrije Universiteit, I still had cooperation with Susumu Tajima mm-hmm. on silicon containing ions. That had to do with the silicium industry. Frans Pinks, I mentioned.
Yeah.
Wim van der Hart. That is the ultraviolet photodissociation work at the University of Leiden. So when I said phenoxyethyl chloride, the final experiment which solved that it was a cyclohexadienone, the keto structure of phenol, that was done with Wim van der Hart, with whom I had a very good relationship, but he was at the University of Leiden, and I even thought perhaps he could join my group. He was at the group meetings in my group. And then Noel Venema, he is here on the list. He did very good work in the beginning of my career, PhD student, but then went to industry. He was a student who came late in his career that he started to study at the university. And then, so he had a high technical school education, but it allowed him to enter the university. And Noel, after his PhD, he was an extremely good PhD student, and he joined AkzoNobel in Arnhem. And he became part-time professor in analytical chemistry in Ghent, Belgium. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, he passed away because of pancreas cancer. No. Yeah. Too young.
Yeah.
Absolutely too young.
Yeah. That's one of the worst ones.
Yeah, it's one of the worst ones. And then you see on top of the research colleagues, that is Roel Fokkens.
Yes.
Roel Fokkens, that is the man with fingerspitzengevoel. He was originally a lab technician. He could operate all kinds of different instruments. And I said to Roel, please try to do it as long as you can. But Roel had an education, not an academic training, but like Noel Venema, that allowed him to go up for a PhD, an academic degree at the university. So his pre-schooling was such, that is possible. And he worked for many years with me. And we had many other scientists coming worldwide to our group, to our institute. And so Roel is also on many papers, co-author. And the scientists who were in my group from outside the Netherlands, they said, a very capable man. And then when I got more or less in the States, that for the early retirement because of a reorganization, I don't know, bother you with that. But then I said to Roel, if you would like to stay at the university and will get a good position, then at least you should have your PhD. And that was possible for him. And I contacted also the scientists with whom in the world with whom he did measurements and studies, mm-hmm. and they fully agreed. Mm-hmm. So then I said, Roel, but I cannot be your supervisor, mm-hmm. because we are too much connected with each other.
Sure.
And so I asked Jan van der Greef, who received his PhD with me, mm-hmm. Jan, would you like to act as the promoter, so to speak, for Roel Fokkens to get his PhD at the University of Leiden. Mm-hmm. And so it worked out. Well. Then he moved from the University of Amsterdam to the University of Twente to work in the group of David Reinhout. Mm-hmm. By the way, that instrument which we had, that was David's instrument, you know, mm-hmm. we moved that back to the University of Twente. Yeah, I didn't have to move. Mm-hmm. But he took it back, and they were very upset in the University of Amsterdam. But yeah, that was the deal.
Yeah.
Because David said to me, if you are not there anymore, then I will take the instrument back to Twente. Mm-hmm. And Roel started to operate with that instrument. There was already other instrumentation, and he built up also their mass spectrometry. Mm-hmm. But then at a certain point in time, he decided to join industry. And he went to a pharmaceutical company in Nijmegen, called Synthon. Mm-hmm. Because you know, perhaps also in the United States, that pharmaceutical companies, some of them are in the Netherlands. Organon was a pharmaceutical company taken over by Merck, mm-hmm. and Merck was more centralizing. But Synthon came out of an organic chemist from the University of Nijmegen who started that company. Synthon is spelled S-Y-N-T-H-O-N. T-H-O-N. Synthon.
C-H-O-N.
Synthon, you would say Synthon. Mm. Yeah, but Synthon. And it is very successful, and Roel became head of the analytical division. And I've understood, I have regular contact with him. He has now 350 employees in the analytical department, because they have also branches of that company here in the United States, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, mm-hmm. but also in Argentina, in Spain, in the Czech Republic, in Australia. So it was very successful. So for me, it is also a pleasure to see that Roel did very well, not only at the university, but also in industry.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So I guess I see it's interesting you have all these collaborations. You have papers with so many other co-authors
yeah.
from all over the world, a lot of America,
yeah.
Some in England, some in Europe.
Yeah.
And it's like, I guess your initial travel on the Royal Dutch Shell thing kind of got you interested in collaborating with
yeah.
people around the world.
Yes, that is one thing, but I think also my character is in that way. Really. Yeah,
I think so. Yes,
because you know, I never forgot, of course, to do my own research. Eh?
No.
Because you know, if you are all the time doing measurements for other people, then people will say he's like a lab technician. Eh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that is, I wanted to do my own research and then also instrumental developments. Yeah. I have driven motorbikes, so that helps also, that you are interested in instruments. But I liked also to do the applications, which was also necessary to get money. I mean, if it's difficult in a chemistry department to say, I would like to have an instrument and then do only my own research.
Yeah.
The instruments were at that time too expensive. It's completely different from physicists. Mm-hmm. They build an instrument and then they do their PhD. They run only themselves, that instrument and nobody else. Mm-hmm. That was not in the case in our case. And so therefore John Bowie, who was in Amsterdam, he was surprised to see how analytical service was mixing with research. So one day we did that, next day it was completely pure research. And then again applications. Mm-hmm. But the applications gave us also the opportunity to learn about other fields. Mm-hmm. Isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah.
And get those interactions
yeah.
You wouldn't get any other way.
Yeah, sure.
So, I don't know, is there anything else? We've talked about all these people.
I think so. I see the name of Don Desiderio. I'm doing the book series of Wiley with him.
Oh, yeah.
Because Dom and I were the co-editors of Mass Spectrometry Reviews. Originally, that was done with Maurice Bercy.
Mm-hmm.
But Maurice had then, I think, some health problems for temporarily. And then I continued to keep the journal alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the system is different in Europe than in the United States. So it was really difficult for me. But then I managed, and then Dom was in the picture to become co-editor. So he found me, and he had informed about my person, how I was. And that was a very good combination. But then in 2001, the 1st of October, I officially had to retire with an early retirement because of reorganizations. But I said to Dom then in 2000 already, I cannot continue that without a secretary.
Yeah, yes.
But then Dom said, we have had such a nice cooperation over all the years. And I said, okay. But he said, could you help me with the book series? Then I checked with him how much work it would be. And I said, okay, I will do the book series.
Okay.
And then we discussed, of course, the Mass Spectrometry Reviews journal. And, Dom is now editor-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
That was decided also then. And my opinion is you should have somebody in the fundamental part, hey? One for instrumentation and one for application.
Okay.
And at the moment it is Einar Ugarud,
mm-hmm.
and Paul Fouros, and Carlo Librita.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning we had Michael Gilhouse from Australia, because I said also to Dom, Mass Spectrometry Reviews, that journal, that's my opinion about mass spectrometry anyhow, but it should be worldwide.
Mm, yes.
So don't put only Americans in the editorship. Yeah? I mean, take editors also from other parts of the world. It's better.
Exactly.
And that worked out also well, except that Michael Gilhouse passed away too early, also because of cancer problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with Graham I had a cooperation already in the beginning of my career, 1974.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He came along and I worked on a problem and he said I could help you. It was nice, and since that time we always kept contact. We did angle resolved mass spectrometry with him to mm-hmm. compare it with field ionization kinetics. Yeah. Fred, you know, John Bynum, when he was at Purdue we had already cooperation.
Uh-huh.
Mike Rose is known.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Derrick, field ionization kinetics.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Jennings, because of collision activation studies. Keith was the man from the collision induced dissociation.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Bowers, Mike is a physical chemist. I like Mike very much. And we did also editing and special issues for Keith Jennings. And so I've never had a paper with Mike Bowers. Hey. We did the special issue for Keith Jennings, but I think it is a very good colleague, and he informed me also about what was going on in his lab,
mm-hmm.
and asked my opinion about it, and a wonderful colleague, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Richard Caprioli, he is the editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of Mass Spectrometry, mm-hmm. together with Michael, so, and Richard also tried to get me as editor-in-chief for the Journal of Mass Spectrometry, if I remember correctly. But Peter was editor-in-chief for the Organic Mass Spectrometry Journal, and Richard was the Biomedical mm-hmm. Mass Spectrometry Journal. And I tried to keep Peter in the business, but you know, that didn't work out. But I didn't want to be unfair with respect to Peter. And so I said, I can only be a regional editor,
mm-hmm.
not more.
Okay.
Although whether Peter that understood at that time, I don't know. Well, okay, that doesn't matter. Okay?
Yeah.
You know, there are sometimes things that happen in your career which you say, well, you cannot avoid everything, yeah?
Yeah.
Emilio Galpi, he was one of the first founding members of the International Mass Spectrometry Society. At least we were the first members of the International Mass Spectrometry board, I would say. Graham was president. Emilio was vice president. I was treasurer. John McLeod from Australia. You can find it in the literature, of course. Mm-hmm. He was a member. Graham asked me also to think about the people from other sides outside Europe, because the International Mass Spectrum Conference started in Europe and were always held in Europe.
Right.
So I divided the world in three regions. That was Region A, Europe. Region B was Southeast Asia and Japan, and Region C was America and the South Americas, mm-hmm. Canada, yeah? So you had representatives from these parts. And, yeah, you know, I was chairman of the International Mass Spectrum Conference in the 12th International Mass Spectrum Conference in Amsterdam in 91. Mm-hmm. And in organizing that, because the bid was accepted in Swansea, mm-hmm. The 10th was always 6 years before. Mm-hmm. And, well, I had a team around me that worked perfectly. Piet Kistemaker and other people, and I myself was also for the science. So that was, well, I got the congratulations from many people. It was a very well-organized conference, very successful. But there were financial problems. Mm. The exhibition saved us, I can say to you. Because if we would have live on the participants, then it it'd be negative. Hmm. But we split up budget for the exhibition, and then said to the official organization, they were involved as an official organization for conferences, we said we should get so much percentage of the exhibition, and that saved us. Mm-hmm. But then I discussed, I remember, with John Bynum and with Graham Cooks. I said to them, I don't understand why money which is left over, if there is left over from a previous conference, cannot be used for other upcoming conference in the internet. Because the physicists did that. That I knew. Mm-hmm. And I think that was picked up, that idea, more and more by Graham also, and John Bynum, I think, also. They said, yeah, that is a logical thing.
So what would happen to the money?
Yeah.
In other words, at the end of the conference, there's money left over. What do you do with it? Do you give it back to the people? I mean, do you give a percentage back to the people that...
The thing was that we said we are not aiming to make profit.
Right.
There's no way.
No.
But if money is left, then it should be used only for promotion of mass spectrometry. Yeah?
Yeah.
That was a problem, because in Amsterdam, or in the Netherlands, we were part, what was mass spectrometry? That was a discussion group under the umbrella of analytical chemistry, under the umbrella of the Royal Netherlands Society for Chemistry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then when we had the bid for 91 in Amsterdam, decided by the governing, the international committee in Swansea, then I got in touch with the Royal Dutch Chemical Society, and I said, we would like to organize that conference, because that has been approved. And money which will be left over, that should be used only for mass spectrometry. And they were very angry. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, the mass spectrometrists, they decide for their field, isn't it? So then that ended up in the Dutch Society for Mass Spectrometry in the end, or the Netherlands Society for Mass Spectrometry. Of course, the discussion group was founded on the 26th of February in 1964.
Okay.
I did my master's degree, so I remember that meeting.
Okay.
So there was an existing body for mass spectrometry, but it was not a society. But that was transformed in a society because of the 91 meeting.
Okay.
But I said also to the chemistry, it took seven meetings to get it done, because chemistry, I said, it is not only chemistry, it is also physics. So it should be under the umbrella also of the Netherlands Physical Society. And that was accepted. So we were an independent society, but under the umbrella of the Physics Society and the Chemical Society. And then money left. We made a scheme also. Well, Graham helped, of course, because you could copy that a little bit more from the ASMS. Yeah. Eh? Mm-hmm. If money is left, then a certain percentage is transferred to the next conference.
Okay.
Yeah? But I don't know how it is at the moment working, because so many years ago, that changed all the time.
Yeah.
But now you see also how the connections is with Graham and with John Bynum, mm-hmm. etc. Yeah. I see Brian, and with Emilio Galpi, of course, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I see Brian Green, yeah, Brian, wonderful man.
Crazy guy.
But wonderful.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the Fiji Micromass decision to take that instrument contrary to a MAT machine, because we had good experience with MAT. You came with your samples and asked to run, of course, the spectra and asked for all kind of experiments.
Yeah.
And Brian was always in favor of it. Uh-huh. Said, Brian, can you do that? Oh, yeah. And it was an excellent demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the way in which he worked.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brian is perfect.
Yeah.
He is still going to the lab.
Really?
Yeah. Smokes still a lot, I've understood.
Yeah, like a chimney.
Now, Alex Harrison, I met him, of course, in the first trip to the United States. So that was the last one I visited, 69. There is a Dutchman who got also his PhD before I was in mass spectrometry. That was Feyer Meyer.
Oh, yeah.
He became a very important director at Philips.
Mm-hmm.
So there was the connection with the Netherlands also, and later on Jan Zwinselman spent his postdoc with Alex, so mm-hmm. I know Alex for that reason also for many years. Carlito Librila, he came over to Amsterdam, he was in the group of Helmut Schwarz to do experiments on the sulfur stuff with mm-hmm. Asmus, etc.
Okay.
Cy Meyerson, well, I mentioned I met him during my trip through the United States in 69, I visited him. But we had also a paper, we looked at what he had done, and propionitrile, and then Carla Thijsling was in my group, and we did experiments, and I said, that's important for Cy Meyerson to know, so we informed him and sent him the manuscript, and he made some comments and said, Cy is the co-author.
Mm, nice.
Simple as that, hè?
Yeah.
Ken Tomer, Michael came over frequently to Amsterdam because we went on holidays, but he was also in the lab, and at that time we had compounds, endorphins from Organon Os, from a pharmaceutical company.
Mm-hmm.
So peptides, ACTH peptides, and Michael, I informed Michael about it. He said, oh, I'm interested, can I get also these compounds? You know, these compounds were released from the company when it was not critical, of course, so like we could do the experiment.
Yeah.
But to compare the collision activation spectra on the Mike's, the ZAP machine, and compare that with the Kratos triple sector instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very useful collaboration in addition to other project we had with Michael. But which instrument was better then? Yeah, there were differences, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
And John Bowie. Yeah, John Bowie came when he made a trip to England, I think in the somewhere in the mid-70s, and came along, and he did see that we had a book on negative ions from Ardenne.
Mm.
And he thought it was interesting. I don't say that John is smart enough and knows exactly what he has to do. But he moved into negative ions.
Mm-hmm.
And I visited him a number of times, and I had cooperation with him sometimes. And even after my retirement, he had a question about thing, and then I proposed something. I said, you should be co-author.
Mm-hmm.
So John is a nice colleague,
mm-hmm.
a real physical organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Well, going through those collaborations that are outside of your immediate area. We talked about your publications, about the most significant ones.
Yeah, at least as far as I see it,
yeah,
huh?
Well, that's what the question is for.
Yeah.
I think we've pretty much covered everything.
I think so, huh? Hey?
Except I guess there's one thing I did want to touch base on. Maybe we'll cover that. I'd like to do the video, too, but why don't we take a break and have some chow, and then we can do the video, and I'll ask that in the video.
I see Matt, your career... significant issues affecting your career direction. Oh yeah, you have heard that good events, bad events.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the bad events. I mean, you can imagine if there is a reorganization, then mechanisms become into operation, which are, in my opinion, not always rational.
Mm-hmm.
There are more things to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gets other considerations begin to take precedence.
Exactly. Yes. But fortunately, the Vrije Universiteit, because I had a good contact with there also for the analysis stuff which I did for them, and they also said, we will not go into do research in mass spectrometry, but they had equipment to analyze, but not all the instruments. So they came to us like other universities. And so therefore they said, when they noticed the problem of early retirement, why don't you come here as a guest?
Mm-hmm.
So during my sabbatical, I traveled a lot, but on the 1st of October 2000, I went there already, got a room.
Mm-hmm.
And... worked on the encyclopedia, participated in the group meetings of Steven Stolte is the name. Steven Stolte is the colleague,
mm-hmm.
physicist from origin, but in physical chemistry. One of his students got his PhD with me.
Mm-hmm.
So you know then how the interaction was.
Okay.
Steven Stolte, still a very good colleague.
Good. Okay, I think we'll push the end, stop the recording button.